You know that thing where you get an amazing pair of shoes at a really great price and want to tell everyone about it? Yeah, so do we. Here at Designer Shoe Warehouse, we'll give you something to brag about. Like the latest styles from brands you love, or the trends everyone's obsessing over, or shoes that make you feel like, well, you. So go ahead, show off a little. Find shoes that get you at prices that get your budget. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today. DSW. Let us surprise you.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Last week on Campus Files.
I called the phone number on the ad for Brooks, and then he started asking me questions about my life.
Not much money is spent on education. A lot of the money goes to advertising and recruiting.
I enter my recruiter's office, and he is angry. And he turns to me and he goes, "I am so sorry, these people are liars."
The for-profit college industry ran wild in the 2000s.
50% of our income went to these loans for many, many years. Scamming borrowers from these schools is by design. It's intentional.
My experiences with education have been life-changing. And it was really a surprise to me to find out how different other people's experiences could be.
That's Eileen Connor. If you've listened to Campus Files for a while, you'll recognize Eileen from our past episode, Trojan Chorus. In that episode, we covered how her organization, the Project on Predatory Student Lending, also known as the PPSL, sued USC after they allegedly ripped off students by partnering with a for-profit company to offload a chunk of their courses.
I knew that there were so many resources going into advocating on behalf of schools. It just felt like somebody needed to be the legal resource and like the passion standing up for students, because they were the ones who weren't being considered at the table.
In 2015, just a couple years after the PPSL was founded, there was a crisis in the for-profit school industry. A crisis which brought attention to a little-known law. A law which offered a crucial escape hatch for people like Mike and Ashley, who you heard earlier in this series. It's called Borrower Defense to Repayment, or more simply, Borrower Defense. In this third and final part of our for-profit mini-series, we're going to take a look at borrower defense, what it is and why it's important. Because it is important. In many ways, the future of for-profit schools as a whole are tied to the future of borrower defense. And right now, there's a battle playing out in the courts and the federal government, a battle which may determine the future of this industry for decades to come. I'm Ian Mont. This is Campus Files, For-Profit, Part 3. The evidence is clear. Over the last few episodes, you've heard about for-profit schools and the ways they've manipulated students, leaving people like Mike and Ashley buried in debt for years. But during all that time, there was a lifeline available, one neither of them knew existed. It's called borrower defense. And if they knew about it, it could have changed everything.
This provision in the Higher Education Act for borrower defense has been part of the direct lending program ever since it came into being as a demonstration program in the early 1990s.
So, what is borrower defense? Well, you can think of it as basically like a refund. The law allows students who take out a loan to have that loan forgiven if they chose to take it out based on lies and deception. It's exactly what happened to Mike and Ashley. They could have applied to have their loan canceled, but neither of them knew the law existed. In fact, there were less than 100 students who tried to use the law between 1994 and 2015. And that's because the sort of deceptive practices that Bar Defense was designed for weren't so widespread when the law was created. So it was kind of forgotten about, and there weren't many lawyers focused on the issue at the time. But that would change as for-profit schools grew. Here's Eileen.
Essentially, you have these giant behemoth chains of for-profit schools sucking in a ton of money, creating a ton of debt, touching the lives of so many people over this time. They didn't get jobs. They couldn't repay their loans. It kind of caught up to these schools because their business model really relied on not being honest about what they were providing.
As the industry grew, it became a victim of its own success. Earlier, Ashley told us about a class action lawsuit against her alma mater, the Brooks Institute. That was just one of many similar lawsuits. These stories kicked off investigations from watchdogs, including Kamala Harris, who was at the time the California Attorney General. If you remember from our last episode, Harris investigated Corinthian Colleges, a for-profit chain that operated more than 100 campuses. In 2015, Corinthian suddenly shut down. Her findings contributed to Corinthian's collapse. And that collapse was a turning point. Suddenly, tens of thousands of students had a mountain of debt and either no degree or a practically worthless one. So this moment brought Borrower Defense into the spotlight.
So I actually learned about it from my good friend Bruce. He said, hey, there's this Facebook group. It's about Borrower Defense. And so he sent me a link and I went and looked at it.
That's Teresa Sweet. Teresa was actually at the Brooks Institute at the same time as Ashley. And Teresa's story should, unfortunately, be pretty familiar at this point. She graduated with $40,000 in federal loans and around $100,000 in private loans. And just like Ashley, Teresa set up loan forbearance, which allowed her to pause making payments, but crucially, did not pause interest on her loans. She did that because she couldn't make payments while searching for full-time work. So the loans just kept growing in the background. And all this time, Brooks, which had promised her substantial career counseling and connections, provided no support beyond links to Craigslist postings. She stayed in forbearance as long as she could, between 2 or 3 years, because she had no other choice. In that time, her loans grew from $140,000 to a staggering $470,000.
At one point, they expected somehow that I was going to make payments that were bigger than what I actually brought home after taxes. And I just would tell them, you know, like, as they say, the math isn't mathing. And so I tried really, really, really hard to get them to work with me on some kind of reasonable payment because I did want to pay the loans. I didn't want to go into default.
Teresa struggled with that debt for years. So when Corinthian collapsed and everyone started talking about Borrower Defense all of a sudden, it was the first moment of real hope Teresa had felt in a long time.
I was pretty excited filling it out because for all the difficulties that I know our justice system has, I was raised by a history buff and that whole, you know, moral arc of the universe and all of that stuff bending toward justice, I still to a pretty large degree believed that.
Teresa submitted her application in 2015, but she didn't realize that time was quickly running out. Because in November of that year, Donald Trump was elected to the White House, and he planned to pick Michigan native Betsy DeVos to head the Department of Education.
Knowing DeVos from being from West Michigan myself, I knew educators back home who had been dealing with her for decades and the sort of havoc that she was bringing to public education back home. And I just thought, this is going to be a disaster.
Here's Eileen.
Betsy DeVos is ideologically opposed to the idea of debt cancellation. She stated publicly that she thought it was an attempt by students to raise their hands and get free money. Had herself been an owner of a for-profit school chain, appointed senior officials who had very close, direct financial ties to the for-profit college industry in her department.
In the final few months of the Obama administration, the Department of Education approved some 28,000 borrower defense applications, many from Corinthian students. But it's never that simple. Once the application was approved, they still had to track down each student's lender, actually cancel the debt, issue a refund, all of that. It's a long process, and it doesn't end with just the application. Obama's team ran out of time. So when Betsy DeVos took charge, it became her job to oversee loan forgiveness. At first, she actually tried to reinstate the loans, but courts ruled her plan was illegal. So she was forced to sign off on forgiveness.
When the court finally ordered her to follow through with their group discharge, she actually signed the checks with extreme displeasure, Betsy DeVos.
While things didn't go DeVos's way this time, that wouldn't stay the case for long. She halted the review of borrower defense applications and started overhauling the process. That was possible because the law that created borrower defense just says it exists. It doesn't spell out how it's implemented. That is left up to the Department of Education. So now, Betsy DeVos, who opposed debt relief in general, was in charge of writing the rules, and she tightened them significantly.
That's something that was really striking under the first Trump administration, is that they were clear. The same amount of fraud is going to happen. We're just going to rewrite the rules so that 95% of people who apply are going to get rejected. They didn't have a problem with the fraud. They weren't going to do anything to make sure that fraud didn't happen and therefore we don't need borrower defense. They just wanted to get rid of borrower defense.
The way DeVos tightened the rules is really important. The main thing she did was raise the level of proof required. That may sound pretty sensible on the surface, but think back to when you were checking out colleges for yourself or your kids. Were you meticulously collecting, noting, and recording everything a school said about itself? Do you still have the flyers you got in the mail? Can you prove what your tour guide told you while you were on campus? No? Oh, well, under these rules, you'd be ineligible for relief, even if your school engaged in the most extreme examples of deception. Teresa was in California while all of these changes were taking place, fighting against the rollback.
We spoke in committee and I ugly cried and it was horrible. But I did have some legislators come up to me afterward and say, I had no idea. Thank you for sharing your story. Please don't give up. At that same meeting, we watched, I'm not kidding when I tell you this, the for-profits and their lawyers showed up in luxury tour buses and like piles of icky attorneys in shiny suits. We start coming out and talking about, you know, how they're so wonderful and, you know, they're a gift from the heavens because they work with alternative types of students.
By 2019, almost 200,000 people were waiting for a response to their borrower defense application. And one day, Teresa was put in touch with someone at PPSL who had been monitoring the situation.
There's a potential for a lawsuit about the halt in processing borrower defense applications. Would you be interested in talking to them about that?
So Teresa met with Eileen and the team at the PPSL. She didn't just agree to help. She stepped forward to become the public face of the fight for loan forgiveness. Teresa was about to lead a lawsuit against Betsy DeVos and the U.S. government.
June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples, breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
In 2019, Teresa Sweet agreed to become the lead plaintiff in a major lawsuit against the federal government over fraudulent debt from for-profit schools. Out of thousands of potential plaintiffs, Teresa was chosen because she'd already been fighting for loan relief, she had an enormous amount of debt, and she wasn't afraid to dive into the complicated details of a lawsuit. The case would bear her name, Sweet V. DeVos. But Teresa didn't expect it would make her well known. After all, in most class action cases, the lead plaintiff rarely gets much attention.
I figured probably some obscure education journals might follow it. When they told me, you'll probably have to do some media interviews and things like that, I just thought, okay, you know, I'm like a weirdly private person, so I didn't think it'd be a big deal. It was very soon after the lawsuit was filed, they called me and wanted to set up a first interview. And I said, well, who's the interview with? And they said, Teen Vogue. And I just went instant panic.
Teresa had a moment of panic, but it didn't last long. She quickly pulled herself together and decided to use her new platform to keep fighting, not just for herself, but for everyone affected.
It sunk into me, you made this commitment. This is something that affects tons of people in the same exact traumatizing way that has affected you, and you agreed to represent the class, and if that's what it takes, then you need to just suck it up and do it.
That commitment was so important to Teresa because there were thousands of people waiting for an answer. And suddenly, she represented all of them.
There's a group on Facebook. I did not start it. I heard about the group and I went in there and kind of peeked around to be like, what's going on in this group here? And it turned out to just be people who were part of the lawsuit that, you know, were trying to connect and share information. And so that group went from a few hundred people to now it's around 16,000, give or take. So somewhere around 2,000 members, I had to shut off access to my DMs because there was literally no way I could respond to everybody.
While Teresa got accustomed to being in the public eye, the lawsuit was progressing along. The goal initially was to get the department to finally process the backlog of applications.
I went to all of the in-person negotiating sessions, which as a non-attorney, it's not how most people would choose to spend an afternoon. You know, I was fascinated. Because I was also really mad that this thing had happened to me.
By April of 2020, they had a draft settlement, which DeVos's team had agreed to. They sent the settlement to the judge for his review. The draft agreement had been signed off on by the plaintiffs, including Teresa, and by DeVos's team. All they needed was for the judge to approve it. But while they were waiting, Teresa received a letter about her borrower defense application. It was denied.
I remember when I got my denial, I actually rolled my eyes and laughed because I just thought, well, I'm the named plaintiff. They're just retaliating against me.
But Teresa wasn't the only one. Thousands of others got denials at the same time.
Seeing how it affected all of the other tens of thousands of people who got denials as well, you know, I was fielding hundreds of direct messages a day and just seeing the heartbreak on people's faces and hearing the heartbreak in the stories that they would tell, you know, it was really upsetting.
The mass denials were a big problem. They had an agreement with DeVos's team. This wasn't supposed to happen. And on top of that, the rejection letters made no sense. The agreement required fair and reasoned responses to applications. But now, DeVos was issuing blanket denials with no explanation. So Teresa and thousands of borrowers were left in limbo, waiting to see what the judge would do.
It was a very tense period of waiting, I think. That was going to be sort of, I think, everyone's first real test, and everyone's kind of holding their breath and waiting to see, well, we know this nonsense is happening. Now, what is the court going to do? And he came up and said how it played out was disturbingly Kafka-esque. I think that was when we knew that the court wasn't going to put up with any nonsense.
In a Zoom hearing with more than 500 borrowers, the judge said that DeVos had negotiated in bad faith and declined to approve the settlement. The judge then took a somewhat unique step by allowing for discovery. Here's Eileen explaining what that meant.
We could ask behind the curtain for documents. We could take depositions of people. And I think what we saw really changed the case.
Remember, the lawsuit was initially just asking DeVos to finally review the applications after they sat virtually untouched for years. But discovery provided an incredible opportunity to see how the department planned to actually handle these applications. Eileen's team learned that attorneys were expected to review an entire application in only about 12 minutes, that the department aimed to deny at least 90% of applications, 7 times more denials than under Obama. Attorneys were also told to ignore sworn statements from borrowers, even when multiple applicants from the same school described the same lies and deception. And maybe most frustrating of all, in cases where the department itself had penalized a school for misconduct, evidence of that misconduct is ignored. So even if DeVos's own investigators find consistent fraud, as happened on multiple occasions, that evidence can't be used. Essentially, the rules of borrower defense were tightened so much that it was nearly impossible to get relief. Armed with this information, the PPSL amended their lawsuit to demand a more fair process. In the midst of this, Trump lost his bid for re-election. But the lawsuit didn't stop just because Trump left office. The applications still needed to be reviewed, and to be reviewed in a fair way. When Biden took over the White House in 2021, the change was almost immediate.
It felt like the Trump DOJ was very, like, it was just standoffish, almost like dismissive. I very much had like this gut feeling that they didn't want to work it out. Whereas I felt like things changed under Biden where, yeah, there were still definitely some disputes happening, but I felt like they wanted to get somewhere.
By the middle of 2022, Biden's Department of Education and the PPSL had reached a new settlement. And finally, in November of that year, the settlement was approved.
All hell broke loose. It was a party in the streets. It was a party on the Facebook page. You know, we had like posts of dance music threads going and party music. And it just, you know, it was a really good feeling that after all of that time, we finally got something that we thought was fair and it was real.
For Teresa, it was a cathartic moment. For years, she'd been the face of this struggle and had heard from hundreds of people about how they were harmed by for-profit schools.
There's one story that always really stands out to me. And it happened about a year and a half ago. I had this gentleman tag me in the Facebook group and say, you know, I know that you don't check your DMs, but could you please, please look for a DM from me? And I went and I looked. He said that he got his discharge that day. And he was so happy because he had terminal cancer. And he said, I'm lucky because it's a slow one. But now that I got my discharge and I'm going to get my refund, I get to quit my job and I get to spend the last of my days on earth with my family. I think about that guy all the time, all the time. Whenever I'm having a crappy day, I think about that guy. And I know he's not alone. You know, people that, no, I can get my knee surgery because I can finally afford my co-pays, or like, oh my gosh, I can get that rotten wisdom tooth pulled. I can buy a house. I can start a family. That makes every single bad part that ever came out of this absolutely 100% worth it, a million times over.
The settlement was a huge victory for borrowers, but there was still a mountain of applications to review, more than 770,000 as of 2023. This story isn't over yet, because for-profit schools weren't going to stand by and let this new process stand.
I hear a lot from people that there are days where it's hard to read a single news story. Forget actually being caught up. But I host a podcast that can fix that. It's called The Seven. Seven stories every weekday by 7 a.m. Eastern. And here's the other thing. It's short, less than 10 minutes, in fact. I'm Hannah Jewell. The Seven podcast will turn around your morning and get you caught up. Check it out and follow The Seven wherever you listen to podcasts.
The last couple decades have been a time of monumental growth, pushback, and conflict over for-profit schools. And now, in 2025, things are coming to a head in a major way. A case currently working its way through federal courts may permanently change borrower defense, and attempts to dismantle the Department of Education may remove many key guardrails. So before we wrap up this mini-series, I wanted to take a moment to talk about what the future may look like for both borrower defense and for students of for-profit schools. And to better understand that, I contacted Jason Altmaier. Here's Jason.
I am the president and CEO of Career Education Colleges and Universities. We represent about 800 campuses across America of career and technical schools, mostly for-profit schools.
Jason was a healthcare lobbyist before joining Congress, where he was one of the few Democrats to repeatedly vote against the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. After he left Congress, Jason got a job at a Florida health insurance company. Eventually, in 2020, he took over Career Education Colleges and Universities, a trade group also known by its acronym, CECU, or CQ. I wanted to talk to Jason because now that we have a second Trump presidency, he's really well positioned to help craft policy as he sees fit, including policy around borrower defense.
Our concern on behalf of our members, again, mostly for-profit schools, is that borrower defense to repayment, usually during Democratic administrations, has evolved to be used in a way that it targets for-profit schools and allows students who have not been harmed and have not been misled to also have their loans repaid.
If you follow this issue, you'll hear that argument a lot. Lobbyists and owners of for-profit schools complain about how unfair the rules under Democrats are. They'll point to policies like group relief, which Jason says allows a school to be politically targeted.
So rather than go one by one, if you get 200 claims and the department decides that one of those 200 claims has merit from the department's point of view, which of course is subjective, then all of those 200 claims are forgiven.
They'll also point to third-party applications, which allows someone to apply for relief for another person.
So you could theoretically go on LinkedIn, find a for-profit school, whatever type of school that maybe you have a political objection to, and find all the students who have an affiliation with that school, graduated, and file claims on behalf of them.
Let's quickly work through these two critiques, starting with group relief. Now, Jason says the department can cancel a batch of loans based on one extra persuasive application. In truth, group relief is for cases where a thorough investigation finds consistent and widespread abuse, like what Kamala Harris did with Corinthian. As for the claim that a random person could apply on behalf of students at a school they don't like, well, that's actually true. I went to Emerson College in Boston, and we had a completely imaginary rivalry with Suffolk, a school right across the street from us. And as an Emerson alum, I could totally pick some random Suffolk student and apply for borrower defense on their behalf. But just because I can apply doesn't mean anything. What Jason failed to mention is that third-party applications require a very high standard of proof. Again, similar to a thorough investigation, like what Kamala Harris did. Nonetheless, Jason argues that these rules are unfair. For-profit schools even sued to block the rules.
We feel that the worst thing that could have happened would have been for the Biden rules, which were punitive and political and weaponized against for-profit schools, the worst possible thing would have been for those rules to continue. And they're going to be struck down by the courts in any case.
The for-profits won the case, and Biden's rules were blocked. Jason is now able to point to that ruling as proof that Democrats are unfair. But again, it's not so simple. The lawsuit was brought to one of the most profit-friendly courts in the country, which tends to reject regulation of any kind. And the whole case becomes even less credible when you find out that this court's rulings are overturned almost 75% of the time. Either way, Biden's rules were blocked. All the extra avenues for relief were closed. But that might not be the end for the case. The next step would be the Supreme Court, which has the power to rule that entire laws are unconstitutional and therefore invalid. With Jason's support, the for-profit schools have prepared a case asking for borrower defense to be basically destroyed. If they get what they're asking for, then borrower defense will still exist, but will be so hard to use that it becomes basically useless. No matter who's president, and no matter what Congress does.
We hope that in the next 4 years with this administration, we're not just going to overturn everything that President Biden did. We're going to review these issues, come to agreement across the higher education community, do what's in the best interest of students, most importantly, but also schools across higher education. And we're very optimistic that we're going to get an opportunity to make that case.
Ultimately, this all comes down to one central question. Do for-profit companies even belong in higher education? Remember in part one of this series where we outlined the three types of schools in the US: state, nonprofit, and for-profit? The key takeaway was that both state and nonprofits, at their core, exist to educate as their sole objective. For-profits, on the other hand, exist solely to make money. Jason says that that profit motive is a good thing.
you're only going to make profit if you're providing a high quality product. We offer a type of flexibility and innovation that does not exist in the nonprofit and public system. The ability of a for-profit school to look at a problem, to work with employers, to offer students a path to career success, and use innovation in their programming and in their faculty and in their approach. You don't have the same resources and you don't have the same innovative mindset in some of those other settings.
But it's a little hard to take that idea too seriously, given what we've heard over the last few weeks. Here's David Halperin, who you heard in part one of this series.
The evidence is very clear that the opposite is true. Look at Ashford University. California Attorney General took that school to trial and showed that the school engaged in fundamentally deceptive behavior, that the quality of education was poor. That school was bringing in a massive amount of dollars in taxpayer money. University of Phoenix, at one time, its online division had a 5% graduation rate. That school was bringing in, at one time, $2 billion a year in taxpayer money. The Federal Trade Commission, the Justice Department, other agencies have repeatedly found the University of Phoenix has engaged in deceptive practices, and it's made billions of dollars off taxpayers. What's been rewarded in this industry is fooling students, undereducating them, and ripping them off. And that makes sense. The less you spend on education and the more you charge, the more profit you will make per student. And the only way to sell something that bad is through deception.
And that deception has a real harm. Studies show students from for-profit schools earned less after attending than before, and that they are 2 to 3 times as likely to default on their loans. Remember what Mike and Ashley went through? Mike had to choose between groceries and gas. Ashley was laughed out of banks when trying to buy a home. While people like Mike and Ashley struggled, the owners and leaders of these schools prospered.
CEO of Corinthian Colleges had a fancy home that eventually went on the market, the most beautiful home in the Intermountain West with a children's art barn and other massive amenities. Some of these houses I've seen, the CEO of Globe University had his high school class come to a reunion and I was able to see the photos of that. Massive luxury. The reason he was rich was on the backs of single moms, veterans, and other low-income people that his school had scammed.
And that brings me to one final detail about this industry. In cases where a student gets a refund because they were lied to, I assume that the school refunds the money. That makes sense, right? But with for-profit schools, it's different. Not once has a school ever had to return federal aid money as a result of borrower defense.
The for-profit schools act as if they're entitled to the federal financial aid in perpetuity. It doesn't matter what they do, they should be able to keep the money. And that kind of attitude has infected the Department of Education, whether the president is Democrat or Republican. You have to do something really bad with a mountain of evidence to get kicked out of the federal financial aid program.
Given everything we've heard so far, the future seems bright for for-profit schools. But for students, the situation is a bit more complicated. If these schools are allowed to operate without consequences, it's easy to see how that could harm students. But there is a silver lining. Back when Mike, Ashley, and Teresa were students, organizations like the PPSL didn't exist, and student debt wasn't discussed so widely. That legal support and the work of Mike, Ashley, and hundreds of others has made a real difference. Mike, Ashley, and Teresa all won student loan forgiveness through borrower defense, in large part due to the Sweet v. DeVos lawsuit. But there are still many thousands waiting for relief. At the start of our interview, I asked Teresa what it felt like to graduate from Brooks, back before she knew how bad things would get. She said graduation was one of the best moments of her life.
I thought I was going to be there alone. My sister had said she was going to try to come out, but she couldn't afford it. And I had asked my dad, and he didn't think he could afford it either. And so one day I'm behind the bar just working, and all of a sudden I hear my dad say my nickname. And I turn around and I almost jumped over the bar. And, you know, I remember they had all the graduates lined up outside of the theater where we were actually going to walk across the stage and get our diplomas. They had us roped off and it was no parents allowed. Talk to your graduate after. And my dad did not care. He lifted up that rope and he ran behind it and gave me a hug and told me how proud he was. Just hearing my family yell and scream when I walked across the stage, it was probably one of the best experiences of my life. I felt like I had accomplished something. I just didn't know what was around the corner.
And at the end of our interview, I asked her how she looks back on that moment, knowing everything that came as a result.
So, my dad, I'm really glad that he got to have that moment because he passed away before he could see me get out from underneath this. And he was so worried. You know, he saw how I struggled and how I couldn't find housing on my own and I couldn't get a car. And, you know, I had applied for a certain job that, you know, they would run a credit check and I'd get turned down because, you know, I have this $500,000 defaulted student loan sitting on my credit report. And so he knew that in many ways it ruined my life. And he went to his grave not knowing that I was going to be okay. When I look back and I remember just like seeing my tough, gristly old dad, the big tears in his eyes and saying, you know, I'm so proud of you, Risa Bear. I'm just glad I got to have that moment.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Ian Mont. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprunkheiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.